Good evening, everyone, to the fourth day of the class here at London Buddhist Vihar. We continue with the same theme, that is enlightenment. Under the same theme, we are going to discuss today why enlightenment is difficult. At least I find it extremely difficult. Difficult in the true sense of the word. Sorry if I offended. I don't know in your case. Okay. That being said, today we are using some key words. The purpose of having this advanced course is, in our definitions and descriptions, we always come across original Buddhist terms that you may find it difficult to find elsewhere. So because there are so many writings, books, lectures, presentations, seminars, workshops, and so on and so forth on enlightenment by different scholars. But most of the time, scholars present their own opinions on enlightenment in a way that they are justified. Because the different scholars represent, are affiliated with different Buddhist traditions. Depending on the Buddhist denomination or tradition, all the definition of enlightenment would be different. Whereas here, we only use the terms that occur in the Pali Canon and its commentaries and sub-commentaries. The Pali Canon is the continually oldest Buddhist school, to say that in politically correct language, that's the old, continually oldest Pali Canon. Now, first of all, let me go through the list that we are, the term that we are using today. Now, the topic is today, the today's sub-theme is why enlightenment is difficult. And we would start with the identity or make identity of sentient beings with reference to the corresponding Pali word, that is satta, and also together with how the word satta is derived, the etymology of the word satta. So that is basically today we will only use one technical term, because given the short time, we wouldn't have to risk much. And also, we would take as much time as you need to discuss the terms, and you should be accommodated for any questions that you need to ask. Right. Now, why enlightenment is difficult? So this topic has been described by many different schools over the Buddhist history. There are so many Buddhist histories, and one of the key reasons why there are different philosophies, in the plural, different philosophies of the Buddha Dhamma, is the very term Satta that we are using. S-A-T-T-A, Satta. You may be more familiar with its Sanskrit and Sinhalese term, that is S-A-T-T-V-A, Sattva. You are more familiar with Sattva. Sattva means sentient beings, any being that has a consciousness, that can feel. Sattva is, so that is the English, general English translation of sattva or satta is sentient being, sentient of senses, of feelings, of sensations, starting from microorganisms too, like amoeba. So in the future, we will discuss different types of births and rebirths. There we will happen to discuss how that the microorganisms are one of the four types of sattva, but it's too early for us to discuss that. When we discuss consciousness as taught in the Buddha Dhamma, we will discuss that term. Now, even microorganisms, they are also considered sentient beings. For example, for right now, we are starting from microorganisms to the highest being in the universe, maybe human being or maybe divine beings, other beings, Brahmas, different beings. Now, they are all considered sattvas. Even the highest gods are considered, they are sattvas. An amoeba is a sattva. Now, to a certain extent, I mean, in different degrees, on different scales, different beings feel things. For example, an amoeba, when he has the idea of the for the purpose of procreation and sexual tendency, it breaks itself into two, right? Amoeba. That's what we learn. So yeah, the way they exist would be different. Anyway, microorganisms are also included in the category of sattvas, sentient beings. Now, whenever we talked about enlightenment, the primary focus of the Buddha Dhamma is human beings. That doesn't mean that divine beings are excluded. As we always emphasize, human beings are the best qualified sentient beings. They are the best qualified for enlightenment. As we discussed in one of our previous sessions, hell beings are too busy with dukkha or suffering, so they wouldn't stand an opportunity for enlightenment, while heavenly beings are too busy with comfort, they wouldn't stand an opportunity for enlightenment either. But they may, some of them may stand a chance for enlightenment as per the Buddhist canon. But in general, it is the human being that is the best qualified sattva, for enlightenment. Why? We human beings are able to see, equally understand and realize the two opposite situations of our life. The situation of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, and the situation of sukha, happiness, both. And we are also able to understand that dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A, dukkha, that is unsatisfactoriness, and sukha, S-U-K-H-A, sukha, joy, are based on our sensory experience. We are sentient beings means, that is, we are sentient means, we are, all our experiences, all our feelings, our sensations are created out of our sense-based experience. So without feelings, without sensations, we can't talk about our existence. So we are sattvas or sentient beings now. However, in general English, we call sattva sentient beings. But now let's move forward and discuss the etymology of sattva. S-A-T-T-A, sattva. By the way, from time to time, I will pronounce and spell the words because for recording purpose. So the word sattva, S-A-T-T-A, is derived from the root sanj, S-A-N-J, S-A-N-J, pronounced sanj, meaning to hang to cling to hang to cling to. So clinging to something, hanging on to something, or clinging to something at any given moment. says that it describes our identity. Now, I am a sattva. If I conventionally I can come up with a beautiful sugar-coated identity of myself, I am so and so based on our background, religious, spiritual, ethnic, and so forth, positions. There's a variety of things that we can use to describe ourselves. But according to the original definition of the word sattva that occurs in the Buddha Dhamma, sattva is someone or a being that an entity, it's called an entity, that a living entity. Pardon my language, because it's very difficult to explain certain realities in language. So that which feels, that which hangs on to, that which clings to something at any given moment is called sattva. The verb is sajjati. Sajjati, S-A-N-J, sanj is the root, the verbal root, and the sanjati, he clings to, he hangs to. For example, if I use my own name, Bhikkhu Upananda Sanjati. Upananda, the monk, hangs to something, hangs on to something, clings to something all the time. So he is a sattva. If I use myself, it's better to use my own self, myself as an example. This moment, now, as I was writing, getting the terms on the board, I was thinking, my mind was looking for a black pen, a pen with a black ink. Then I remembered that no, there's no one, there's no black ink, there's only blue. Then all of, why not? I should have looked for a black ink, though I forgot it. See how far I went. I created a long thought pattern regarding black ink versus blue ink. However, I ended up grabbing the same marker that would write in blue. See how far I went? Within a minute or so, I created so many thought patterns. Now, so that says a lot about my identity. We always cling to something. So later on, we will come across another standard term, clinging. But not today. I would try my best not to come up with any other, not to use any other Pali terms, because this term itself, sattva, is good enough. Now, for the recording purpose, let me go through the original definition of sattva in Pali, and then I will explain it. Rupadisu khandesu Chandaragena Satta Visatta Ti Satta. You don't have to worry about this Pali term. This is the definition. Probably when you listen to this voice memos, voice record, audio recordings, and again, or probably when you read about Sattva elsewhere in the books, maybe when you listen to them from talks, speeches, etc., then you will remember the definition. It's always good to know the original terms, even though you wouldn't use them in your real life. Now, rupa disu, R-U, long U, P-A, long A, D-I, long I-S-U, rupa disu, khandesu, K-H-A-N, D-H-E-S-U, khandesu, chandaragena, C-H-A-N, D-A, R A long A G E N A Chandaragena Satta S A T T A long A Satta Visatta V I S A T T A apostrophe T I T Sat Visatta Ti Satta. Now, this definition occurs in the book called The Nettipakarana. Nettipakarana. The Nettipakarana. Nettipakarana. Nettipakarana is considered a canonical text, especially in the Burmese Pali canon, Nettipakarana, and it is available here at London Buddhist Vihara in both in Pali and I wonder if the English translation is there. Now, so Nettipakarana is the best, how to say, the best guide of Buddhist hermeneutics. You know what hermeneutics means? Description, the grammatical descriptions of terms. So that is, hermeneutics is a branch of philosophy and linguistics, hermeneutics. 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 So hermeneutics means this about the etymology and the grammar of terms. Now that is the best known Pali guide of Pali Buddhist hermeneutics available in Pali. It is considered a canonical text in the Burmese Pali canon, in Sinhalese and other not in Sinhalese, other Sri Lankan, there's nothing called Sri Lankan Pali or anything. Different, slightly different editions. Oh, Nettipakarana is still there on the list, but Burmese people basically consider Nettipakarana as a canonical text. So do Sri Lankan and other Theravada countries. Anyway, it is a beautiful book, very very difficult and profound book. So that's how the Nettipakarana explains sattva. Rupadisu. Rupa, as you know, is the body, physical body. Rupadisu khandesu, the five aggregates like rupa or the body, that's what it means. Adisu means etc. Rupadisu khandesu, when it comes of the five aggregates, as you know, the Buddha would prefer to describe a being, a sentient being, so sattva, not as an entity, but as a method, but as a combination of five things called aggregates. Why? Because whenever we think about my conventional identity of myself, or when you think about yourself, when someone think about themselves, he thinks of himself, she thinks of herself, even though an animal cannot think maybe, but it feels about him itself, etc. We as sentient beings, human beings, we always think about ourselves subjectively. Our way of thinking is essentially and innately subjective. We are subjective beings. We start our start a description of our identity by using subjective terms. Always we say I. We start with I. I am. I do like this. I do. I don't. I did. I didn't. I will. I won't. I should. I shouldn't. I must. I must not. I may not. So I should. I shouldn't. I always we start from I. Now, some scholars call this, as I think I just mentioned it once in our previous classes, we are always in the making and remaking, making and reinforcing our sattva. That is, where is it? Our sattva, our identity, our make. Like when you say, when I ask about, what is the make of your car? Oh, it's Toyota. I'm not promoting Toyota, Honda, Mercedes. We talk about the make of your car, the make. So this is sattva means the make. The topic, the sub-theme is identity or make of our sentient beings when we talk about ourselves. Now, some scholars, by with reference to a particular Pali term, use an English, how to say, a new age type of English term for self. It's called I amness. I think we did mention that term before, I amness, rather than self or me. I amness means I am always making myself. I'm remaking myself, reinforcing myself. This morning you were angry, so there was an angry you. And towards the noon, you had a chat with your friend, or maybe you meditated, or probably you got yourself distracted by getting involved in something else, and your anger disappeared. And then there was this relatively more peaceful you. And then you took a nap, or went to work, and you had a chat with your co-workers probably. So then you happened to see something, and you got distracted towards the evening. And then there was an even more peaceful you. By the time you came to the temple and sat, grabbed your chair and got yourself ready for the class, you found a perfectly peaceful you. That is called I amness. We are always in the making, and sometimes we are in the business of making ourselves and remaking ourselves. And that is what we always do. We are not happy with the, we don't have a perfect picture of our self identity, sattva. Our identity is very gray. It is a fluid reality. It's not the fixed. Identity is not fixed. It is fluid. It always like a stream. It's very difficult for you to, you can start writing a book about yourself, my identity. I have no idea where the book will take me if I write about my identity. I don't know. See, I just said, I don't know. I didn't mean to say that, but I said. See, that proved what I am. I said, if I start writing a book about myself, I don't know where my book will take me. So we always happen to say, I don't know. I don't know about, I can't imagine. So that is our subject to thinking. Whereas enlightened ones, they have non-subjective thinking. Not subjective. It's not actually proper to say objective thinking. But non-subjective means they, enlightened people look at themselves as an object. Now, you might remember that somewhere the Buddha was holding an amla fruit, AMLA, amla fruit. In Sinhalese, it's called Nelli. Amla is a Sanskrit botanical term. It's a transparent fruit. You can see the seeds inside. It's relatively more transparent than many other fruits. And Buddha was holding an amla fruit on his palm. And then Buddha just explained about the realities. Now, when you, through vipassana, through non-subjective thinking, when you are enlightened, you will be able to see through yourself, understand yourself, realize yourself in the way that you are now seeing through, penetrating through the amla fruit. That's called penetrative wisdom. You can go see through the fruit. Now, it is the enlightened ones, they are free from the so-called, they continue to be sentient beings. But upon getting enlightened, enlightened ones like Buddha, like Sammasambuddha, Paccheka Buddhas, and Arahats, they drop their so-called basic identity. They are the ones who go through the actual transformation of self-identity. They become non-subjective. I think over time we have talked about on different occasions in different talks here. We have again and we have discussed that the only problem is our how to say our clinging. Now, next class, we will talk about we will come across a list of terms, Pali terms corresponding to another teaching in the Buddha Dhamma that is called attachment or craving. Today we are not going to use those terms. We will continue our dialogue throughout the class time about this single term, sattva. Now, again, sattva or satta means clinging to something, hanging on to something. Have you ever experienced a moment that your mind is free from hanging on to something or clinging to something? So I'm just asking a question. You don't have to answer. Think about answer yourself in your head. Have you ever been able to enjoy a moment, experience a moment within which you didn't feel anything? You didn't feel like clinging to something, hanging on to something. I think in our meditations we talk about that. Definitely in meditation. A lot of people shared their experience in previous meditation sessions, few people here, that they have this fascinating moment within which they experience a kind of rapture, kind of joy. That has nothing to do with sensory experience. Now we are as sattvas or sentient beings, we always use our sense faculties to create, to generate our feelings or sensations. Either it's based on our eyes, based on our ears, based on our nose, based on our palate or tongue, based on our skin. And when our mind is not involved, not engaged with any of those five basic sense faculties, and the mind is engaged with itself, mano, M-A-N-O, mano. And mind would go through the data already collected through the first five sense faculties. So that is the sixth sense. Basically, we use our the first five senses. And when we are not engaged with one of those five senses, and the mind would engage with itself. But when you close your eyes at the very beginning, and let's say you stop hearing, you stop listening to something, and you don't go after listening or hearing something. You don't think about smelling something. You don't think about tasting anything. You don't feel. You give up on you. You are not interested in feeling anything tangible with your skin. Primarily, essentially, you are not feeling anything. You are not creating any feeling. Then what happens is the mind starts sending thousands of data, thousands of memories and tendencies into your conscious mind. And that is when you think about the things that you did during the day or maybe years ago. And then you deal with them too. Then you let go of those memories and tendencies and feelings, etc. Then all of a sudden, you don't feel anything, but you feel an unusual, incredible moment of rapture or joy. It's not really a feeling, but because it can still be called a feeling because you feel it. But that is not a sensory feeling. It doesn't come from your sensory experience. It comes from the absence of feelings. Now that is the thing closest to nirvana. It's nowhere close to nirvana. But if you really want to know something, at least now, because we always use that problematic term emptiness, right? We always use the word emptiness. Whereas I personally don't like, see, I'm saying this objectively, I don't personally like it. Upananda doesn't like it. See, again, I'm proving my identity as sattva. I always cling to something that I don't like to. See, I said that again. Even if I don't like, I hate it, but I still cling to it. So now emptiness. So emptiness is, the term emptiness has a negative connotation in the English language. Now, if you go for a descriptive analysis of the term emptiness, it is the absence of the burden of feelings is called emptiness. The absence of the burden of feelings is called emptiness. Your mind becomes empty of the burden of feelings. Now, what type of feelings are a burden? Any type of feelings are a burden. Now, basically there are three types of feelings. So wholesome feelings or positive feelings, or unwholesome or negative feelings. And there's the third kind of feelings are either a mixture of wholesome, unwholesome, or a mixed kind of feeling, or a kind of feeling that is neither wholesome nor unwholesome. So mixed feelings. Now that makes me think about the best definition of meditation in the Pali Canon. Probably that's very important at this point, because why? Meditation is the only way we can experience that feeling of experience the absence of the burden of feelings of any kind. Because in your day-to-day life also you can make it, but provided that you have prior experience of meditation. Sometimes due to high stress, sometimes you don't feel anything, but that's not the absence of feeling. That is called the frozen feelings. Your mind is frozen in thinking. That's called frozen mind. Your frozen mind. Your mind is frozen. Not like the way that you get frozen in case you are reborn into the Brahma worlds of the formless. There's a different kind of frozen consciousness. You feel like that you'd simply say in your expressions, "I froze. I froze. I don't feel anything." That's a different. That's a negative. That's because when you are utterly, deeply in denial. Whereas in meditation, you go through that, you experience the absence of feelings. Now, the best definition I was going to say, it was in the Majjhima Nikaya. So, there is a sweet feeling. Now, there's a you choose a moment and sit in a quiet place. And take a few deep breaths, close your eyes, and then you now begin to see what's going on in your head, in your mind. And this is what you would come across. This is what you would feel. There's a sweet feeling that has arisen in my mind. Or there's a bitter feeling that has arisen in my mind. Or there's a bitter sweet feeling that has arisen in my mind. However, whatever that feeling is, it is not permanent. It has arisen based on conditions, based on a reason, for a reason. And that is fluid, and that is gray, that is not permanent, and it comes and goes. I'm not supposed to cling to it permanently. That is the best definition, to me at least, personally speaking, again subjective. I find it the best and the most fascinating definition of meditative awareness. Actually, that is the vipassana. That's vipassana, the psychoanalytic thinking. That's called vipassana, means psychoanalytic thinking. you make your own psychoanalysis. You analyze your own psyche, right? It's called psyche, your mind. Psyche is a more beautiful term than the mind. So Carl Jung uses the word psyche. He hardly uses the word consciousness and mind. He uses the word psyche. And his one of his followers, Joseph Campbell, also uses psyche. Whereas Sigmund Freud, his senior and contemporary, hardly uses, because he was more like a neuroscientist, Sigmund Freud. Carl Jung, his contemporary and junior, Carl Jung, was more like he's more into applied psychology. And he was more spiritual. I don't know about the spirituality of Sigmund Freud. One thing is, no offense to him, but he has done a lot of self-psychoanalysis, so that is why he speaks his own trauma through his teachings, through his lectures. When you read Sigmund Freud, that's what I felt. He had a lot of trauma. He lived a very traumatic life, if you know this personal history, whereas Sigmund Carl Jung was very different than him. Anyway, so I studied, I was more interested in Carl Jung and also his student Joseph Campbell. I attended some classes at Pacifica Graduate Institute in Carpinteria, California, that is dedicated to Joseph Campbell. I met people from different ethnic and religious background, learning, doing their academic studies on about the psyche. Everyone would talk about feeling. You go to the cafeteria and start grabbing a coffee or a tea, maybe some snack. They would always talk about this, and they would always say, "I prefer this brand over this." Ah, sorry, I'm being subjective, but anyway, I'm subjective. Anyway, I prefer this one. It's always applied terms that we use. Now that's so. Now sattva. Remember, now let me take you back to another term that we discussed the last week. That is the bodhisattva. I think we did mention that one, bodhisattva, Bodhi. That is one of the key terms that we start the first day, on the first day itself. Bodhi, Bodhi, Bodhi. Bodhi means enlightenment, or spiritual enlightenment, or awakening itself. So now, when, because today's is now, why enlightenment is difficult is a sub theme of the main theme, enlightenment. Now, what is, now let's discuss the difference between sattva and bodhisattva. Now, I am a sattva. That doesn't mean that, but there should be a long way for me to become a bodhisattva. Unless I become a bodhisattva myself, I wouldn't be able to become enlightened. So anyone aspiring to get enlightened is, it's a bodhisattva. In Mahayana Buddhism, every follower is considered a bodhisattva. Everyone is supposed to become a Sammasambuddha. Whereas in Theravada Buddhism, that is based on the Pali Canon, there are three types of bodhisattvas. I am doing some writings about this nowadays. It's a very controversial subject. So I want to do some research in the UK, maybe in London, about bodhisattva. In Theravada Buddhism, you come across three types of bodhisattva. Now again, let's touch on that term, bodhisattva. Sattva again is, sattva is one who clings to, one who hangs on to. Now bodhi sat, now what is bodhi then? Enlightenment. So bodhisattva literally means one who clings to enlightenment. That is the only kind of clinging. Next week we will talk about different types of clinging, and we will discuss a bunch of terms explaining craving and attachment. And by the way, there are 108 types of cravings. Too much. If never too much, when I enjoy tanha, cravings. But when I look at the list, I become fed up. But we are not going to touch on all these 108 eight types of cravings, attachments. If possible, I will try to come up, find the whole list and share with you. It should be readily available on Google as well, but I don't know. So now Bodhi is enlightenment and sattva. By the way, do you remember the meaning? The Bodhi, the term Bodhi comes from the root Buddha, Budh, Buddha. And we discussed that term last week, the last week, Buddha, Budh, Buddha, to enlighten, to wake up. That's the most important, that's the easiest and the most fascinating translation, to wake up. Just like you woke up from a fuzzy dream in the middle of the night. Just like you woke up from a scary dream in the middle of the night, and then when you, as you woke up and you took a sigh of relief, ah, it was a dream, I'm still alive. Right? That's how we go through, right? Because I work with how to say anxiety, people with anxiety, and it is very specific. It is fun to share some ideas here, because I work with I did some Buddhist psychological research on how to say sexual, how to say ident so a kind of anxiety that men and women go through, rape anxiety and castration anxiety. Women would always, because we did some research. When a woman walks down the ravine or the street, stroll down maybe all by herself, so this is pure research. And then if you feel like, if a woman feel that there is someone or some people are walking behind, right? Sorry, but I can record my demonstration on this audio record. My friends who would listen to this recording in the future, sorry about that. I can, this is sort of video record, this audio recording. Like when you walk, let's say in the evening, you go for your evening walk. Like this, talking about women. I interviewed like 200 more women from different backgrounds in the US. And then all of a sudden, when you walk down, this is something you do always. When you get on a motorbike, on a bike, you always do this. You, if when you feel like someone is follow coming behind, and you always do this. And that is your biological response to your deeply rooted rape anxiety, because there's a higher probability someone can. And so this is now, this is one example. And then men, and I into like over 450 people, men in different from different religious and ethnic backgrounds in the US. And they also have, sometimes they have fear. Now in their dreams, sometimes when they feel, when they get, especially young people, young men, and then they feel like they, when they are surrounded by other men, or anyone, and they would always touch their, like, use and then cover up or touch their groin area from the front, because they feel like they have that castration anxiety. They might get castrated one day. See, very important things, very important research. That's why I like the psychological approach to religion. Now, those are two types of anxieties, anxiety that we men and women go through. Because there's a higher probability it happened for a reason. Why? Genetically, we went through that. According to one of the anthropological sutras, that is called, I think, Kutadanta, Kutadanta, Kutadanta. Probably late next year, late this year, next year, we will start a sutra club. We will start a Pali sutra study class. In Canada and the US, I ran a sutra club. People like the people, the word club rather than a society something. We would go to a restaurant, or we would study the sutra, maybe in a church. Now, so next year we will do that. So when we look at when it comes to our identity, we are always shaken by anxiety, both men and women. I was going to say, according to Kutadanta Sutra, so it is something genetic. And Buddha talks in that sutra, and many, few other sutras, Buddha talks about the origin of humanity, how primal beings got, and according to, I think, Brahmajala and Brahmajala Sutra as well. The Brahmajala Sutra is, that is the sutra of the, that is the Buddhist story of Genesis. The Buddhist Genesis, story of Genesis, just like you study the Genesis in the Bible. So it is very anthropological. How the life started on Earth, how our primal ancestors, how the, how it says that more attractive ones, that's why, without referring to male or female, it says in universal terms, more attractive ones were targeted by others. That's what the sutra says, more attractive ones. I'm sorry, but I don't remember the Pali, corresponding Pali phrase, and we don't need it right at this point. More attractive ones were targeted by others. So, and then they were subject to forced rape and all that. Somehow, rape and castration and all those sexual related and other kind of fears and anxieties, and then they were built into our genes. Our genes carry those fears and anxieties. That's why we always sometimes certain dreams are created by our genetic inheritance. Some dreams have nothing to do with our real life experience during this lifetime. Some are from our past life, some are from our genes. Because as far as I understand, sometimes I know some family members, some blood, same family members would have the same kind of dreams. And it has not something to do with our genes. I think Sigmund Freud talks about the cultural genes, something, cultural memory. And Sigmund Carl Jung talks about that more. In Buddhism also we talked about, in the Buddha Dhamma you also come across that different, our identity, our sattva, our makeup is made by the, how to say, the psychology that we, that became part of our embryo. According to Mahadhyana Sutra and many other sutras, now the two gametes, right? Two gametes from the mother and the father created the embryo, and the embryo, the two gametes created from the mother and the father built the physical part of the embryo, and the consciousness from a dead person enters in embryo. So it created the psychological aspect of the embryo, and that's so that the consciousness that arrived from the outside as an external force would brought into all the karma, all the habits, and all the memories. And then, so that is the karmic part of our identity. And then Mata Pettika Sambhavasa, don't worry about the Pali phrase again. Mata Pettika Sambhavasa, made by and or of the mother and the father. Sambhavasa, that is the genetical part of our identity. And then as we were born, we started growing up, acquiring language, culture, different things through our sense faculty. That is social aspect of our identity. A sattva or a sentient being is made of all the three aspects. Karmic or karmic slash past life aspect, past life entity, genetical entity from the mother and father or our ancestry. And that's where maybe the with Sigmund Freud refers to the cultural gene, some cultural memory, and then social entity, social aspect. So there are three aspects: past life slash karmic, genetical or genetic, and social. These three aspects together form and enhance and rebuild and reinforce our identity on a continual basis. It never ends. It continues. So that is why it's very difficult. Identity is fluid. According to in the eyes of the Buddha Dhamma, our identity is not fixed. It is not fixated anywhere. It is very fluid. We always change it. We go through change. So you might notice that I'm using less many not many Pali terms today because we need to discuss things, a lot of things today. So because this is a very open-ended class. Now, then a bodhisattva. What a bodhisattva means, once again, there are three types of bodhisattva, right? According to Pali Buddhism or Theravada Buddhism. Someone who wants to be the Sammasambuddha or the pioneering Buddha. It takes you the longest time, many eons, many kalpas in order for you to complete the perfections or paramitas. We'll talk about paramitas maybe in a few months' time. Paramitas. So maybe in a few weeks' time, because it's related to enlightenment. How far? I think, yeah, in a few weeks we will talk about paramitas, so the qualifications that you need to complete in your day-to-day life for the purpose of enlightenment. So Sammasambuddha, as we discussed on the first day, is a pioneering Buddha, and he has to go through the biggest the longest training through across different life forms. And second one is Paccheka Buddha. Paccheka Buddha is the one-way Buddha. He's a very private Buddha, and Paccheka Buddha is as fully enlightened as all. He's enlightened by himself, but he is not in a position to enlighten others about the realities, about the life. In other words, he is not able to enlighten others, help others enlighten. And the third one is Sutta Buddha. We talked about a Buddha enlightened by listening. That is the most general type of Buddhas, or simply you call the Arahats. Arahats in English word, Arht. Arhat, so Arhat, Arahat. Refer to the English dictionary, you will come back to the word Arahat, meaning Arahanta, the Pali word, that is the disciple Buddha, or a Buddha by listening. You have to be in the company of a Sammasambuddha or a pioneering Buddha to get enlightened by listening to him. So that is the Savaka Buddha or the Buddha by listening. You become enlightened by practicing and listening. Now, if you are interested in becoming enlightened, and you can be the third type. Why? You have access to the Buddha's teachings. You can listen to him, practice, and become enlightened. The world is not completely absent of enlightened ones. If a lot of people ask me whether there are enlightened ones, I don't say yes. I don't say no. If I say I have the proof, then you will ask me how, okay, proof. But I don't say no, because I can't prove it. There could be enlightened ones. They don't come forward and say they don't go on social media, or they don't write about books, and they don't boast about their enlightenment. There could be arahats still in the world. So now there are bodhisattva is one who is cling to. That is the only kind of clinging, the best kind of, only good kind of clinging. All other kinds of clinging brings us unsatisfactoriness. And this is where some people mistake the Buddha Dhamma. Now, always those who are both Buddhists and those who are not familiar with the Buddha Dhamma would always ask me this question: why do Buddhist people always say everything is impermanent? Then I would say, I don't say that all the time, but I feel it. Oh, you feel it? Yes. How? Then I would explain. I feel the same. Okay. So then they would, oh yeah, now what I mean by impermanent. Because of our, that is the next thing that we're going to talk about. It's part of our sattva nature, our identity, is that we are not happy with our experiences. No matter how good our experience is, we are happy that we have achieved the best thing in our life. So I have interviewed students who have graduated from the best universities in the world. And I have met people who are very, we are very proud of their wealth and estate. I have met a lot of people who are very, we are very proud of their ancestry, their nation, their, how to say, their nationality, their education, their appearance, their abilities, their talents. And when I ask them the same kind of, when I present them with the same questionnaire, and they would say yes, 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 yes. Then I add the last question, meaning you have no reason whatsoever for complaint, or meaning you are all perfect, there's nothing to worry about. Well, when they open, well, they're going to say something the next time. Well, you know what? They always open up with these phrases. Well, you know what? And that means they're going to complain again. So that I always do this practicalized applied approach. Now, no one is able to claim that they are permanently happy, permanently satisfied. There's nothing called perfection. Now, conventionally we say, okay, a bodhisattva has to complete 10 perfections. As they are not, they are called paramis. That's the wrong translation. P-A-R-A-M-I, paramis. A parami, the English, the general English translation is called perfection. All the scholars translate parami as perfection. In fact, parami is not perfection. Parami doesn't mean perfection. Parami means that which crosses you over. That's what it means. Parami means that which crosses you over, in parenthesis, to nirvana, from the samsara. That's what parami means. The perfection is the wrong translation. So that which crosses you over from samsara to nirvana. So that's what parami means. They are skills. There are 10 skills that you need. And all these skills, and one of them is, and we will probably, let me think about that. You know what? We will talk about the paramitas next week, before it's too long, because I never want to miss that out. Next week we'll talk about the paramitas, because this is one of the teachings that most people are fascinated by, at the same time confused by. Paramitas. Let's next week talk about. We will talk about the 10 paramitas. I will come up with the list. Okay, the 10. According to Mahayana Buddhism, it's 6. According to Theravada Buddhism, it's 10. And somehow the 6 contains the rest 4 too. So in general, there's the 10 paramitas, paramis or paramitas, as you call it, whichever the way. Now, a bodhisattva is always supposed to cling to his awakening, enlightenment. But however, when you hang on to enlightenment means, sometimes when, you know, I mean, you use the phrase, say, when I ask how are you doing, sometimes a lot of people, especially in America, I've been here too, hanging in there. That's why people always say, how are you doing today? Hanging in there. Hanging in there is something, you hang on to something that you almost about to fall and down. And then when you sit down into like a precipice, it's like a crater. And if you fall and there's no way out, and that could be the end of your existence. Now, just hanging in there, meaning that you can't do anything else, but you just survive. Right? So, actually, I like that phrase. I love that English phrase, because I always use that phrase, hanging in there, when I describe sattva, sentient being. So when we talk about our identity. Now, you always cling to enlightenment. When you cling to bodhi, B-O-D-H-I, bodhi, sattva, one who clings to enlightenment. Maybe it's very far away, but what is the difference between being a sattva, like me, Upananda, or a bodhisattva, like you? Like you are bodhisattva, so I'm a sattva. How about that? That's the bodhisattva. I cling, despite my being a monk, I cling to a lot of things. I always, in a way that I may forget my monkhood. No, you're not supposed to think about, lose your monkhood, Upananda. I always advise myself. I'm a monk. Okay. So that no, then so enlightenment. Now, for now, tomorrow, the next week, we will talk about parami. We will continue the same topic with the same sub theme. Now, always I cling to something. Just like I start my class, my mind was looking for, my mind was being monkey-minded. My mind was running here and there, looking for a blue a marker that writes in black. Then I remembered that I should look for a black ink if I really wanted that, but I didn't remember that. I forgot it. When I grabbed the marker that writes in blue, then okay, it's blue again. I had to make up my mind. And once in again, for once or twice, I thought about. I went back to in my memory and told myself, okay, next time before next Thursday, get some markers that writes in black markers. Markers, whiteboard markers that write in black. So see the creator. It creates our thought patterns. Thought patterns. Next week we will talk about two terms. Remember that parami and chittaviti as well. Chittaviti. And right now I will just spell that out. Pronounce the word. If you are so right, you can write it down. I'm not going to write it on the board, because we will use that term next week. Chittavita, Citta, chitta dash vi long I thit, chitta viti, chain of thoughts, not thought pattern, chain of thought. Chain of thoughts then become a pattern. When you stick to the same chain of thought, and you can identify a certain pattern. You put your chains of thought into a pattern, then it becomes a thought pattern. Depending on how far you remain cling to something, you are looking for a partner or someone, and you will have the same thought pattern for many years. Or probably you were with someone and you broke up, and then you continually have the same a different thought pattern, a negative thought pattern. Every time you remember your partner, you get frustrated. If you, I was fooled by that. I fell victim. I shouldn't have gone for that. I hate myself. Who else to blame? I had to blame myself. Another thought pattern. So that's what we always do. Next week we talk about thought, how chains of thought and thought patterns, how chains of thought turn into thought patterns. And you don't, there are some, how to say, what to say, a lifelong thought patterns. Sometimes you don't have to think about anything else, just only one thing in your purpose. Because you cling, you look for something and you found it, then you cling to it. And then you got fed up with that. Then you had difficulty leaving that. And then you somehow did. But still, that connection or that relationship left permanent scars on your psyche. And at the very beginning, your psyche was bleeding, and now it has healed a lot, but scars are there, and you will so those, that experience continually haunts your mind, haunts your life. So that is because of your sattva nature. That's because of your identity. Now, when you think about the only good kind of thing that you are supposed to cling as a bodhisattva, about bodhi. Now, what actually enlightenment is, what bodhi is? You try your best to let go of things that you would otherwise cling to. You reduce the degree of your clinging. Now that is all about, enlightenment is all about letting go, not acquiring anything, but letting go of things. So that is why it's very difficult to explain Nirvana. I think that's one conversation that occurs between Venerable Sariputta, one of the two chief disciples of the Buddha, and another monk, the latter, the second one, another monk who wasn't enlightened yet. Now, this unenlightened monk, As Venerable Sariputta question, he says, Venerable Sir, Buddha has said that there's nothing to enjoy at Nirvana. Then how could you say that Nirvana is the best happiness? And Venerable Sariputta replied, Brother, also means that someone, monks of the same age talk to each other, like brother, also. Avuso, also, meaning like brother, monastic brother. Nirvana is the best happiness because there's nothing to enjoy in it. Now, do you see, did he answer his question? No. The question was, Venerable Sir, Buddha has said that Nirvana is the best happiness. Best type of happiness. But at the same time, he said, there's nothing to enjoy of Nirvana or about Nirvana or in Nirvana. How could you say, how could we then believe that Nirvana is the best type of happiness? And Venerable Sariputta replied, Brother, Nirvana is the best happiness because there's nothing to enjoy about it, of it, in it. He didn't answer anew. He repeated the question. Nirvana is the best happiness. Why? It is absent of the so-called sensory happiness. That's what we discussed in this class at the beginning. So the conventional worldly happiness is it derives from our sensory experience. The sukha, and always. Sukha ends with dukkha. Remember, did we talk about the two terms, right? Sukha and dukkha? Yeah, I think sukha means joy or satisfactoriness. And dukkha is unsatisfactoriness or suffering. By the way, again, my subjective observation, I personally don't like the translation suffering. Suffering. Sometimes some people have told me, my friends who are married, you know that joke actually, the ring, how to say, the wedding ring joke. I know that person. One of my friends said, "Panthi, I go through suffering. So this is my suffer because of this ring. I suffer." You're talking about the wedding ring. So suffering is not the correct translation. It's a negative term because when it comes to dukkha, dukkha is not suffering actually. Negative and no sense. It's a feeling. Negative. Do is negative. Ka is essenceless. Nothing to be taken. There's nothing substantial in that. No substance. No essence. It means ka. Do is negative. Du. Do is negative. Plus ka. Kha. No essence. Nothing meaningful. Sometimes you may at times feel like something missing from your life, and you can define that, you can describe that feeling. Something missing, but you don't know what it is. When you make a whole list of things that you have experienced, and there are negative things too, but you were able to deal cope with those negative experiences. But there was a better number of positive experiences. However, still you feel something missing. That's because of so dukkha is built into our identity. It has nothing to do with the food that we eat. It has nothing to do with the friends that we have. It's nothing to do with the things that we do in our day-to-day life for the sake of happiness. It is built into our sattva, into our being. Because and so that is why how do we at times project? We project that unsatisfactoriness, dukkha nature onto through our feelings. How is that? Now we maintain a subconscious, we subconsciously maintain a notion of permanence. How do we do that? Like in aging, when you age, you run back to your youthful years and say, and you compare, look into old albums and say, I can't believe I have changed this much. No, it's the same. Me, well, just that much. 20 years hasn't made that much difference. No, it has. And all of a sudden, one of your friends come to you and sneak into the pictures over your shoulder. Oh, yeah, you're the same gorgeous lady and a man. You see, I like it. You are the same handsome man. You are the same pretty lady. Oh, really? Thank you. Let's go and have a coffee. Let's grab a beer or something. That's what you do. And so instantaneously, you become happy. That is one of the subtle indications that we love to maintain a youthful version of our sattva, our self. So that's why people always love. But Buddha always, the beauty is appreciated, highly appreciated in Buddha, by Buddha highly appreciated beauty. But at the same time, he gave a warning. Warning means, so appreciate yourself regardless of your age. Appreciate yourself regardless of your age. If you hate your current age and you only love your youthful years, what happens is you are now hating your actual identity, actual physical identity. And you are unrealistically trying to prove, convince yourself that you are the same person in your 20s. So it's very hard reality. So that is when, in the Buddha Dhamma, everyone is beautiful. I always tell children and youngsters, you are beautiful no matter what. And always look at yourself. And if now this is, I did some social research. With some years ago in Paris, I met some teenage girls in Paris. In fact, I spoke to them through an interpreter. They were French speaking. They were suffering from anorexia. Anorexia, eating disorder. They wanted to slim down. However, they slimmed down too much. They had become like walking skeletons. I didn't say that to their right face. I felt it, and so that they had because their body was unable to digest the nutrition anymore. So their bodies were rejecting protein. The bodies were unable to digest protein. So they would suffer a few more years. Anyway, one thing was, they were all beautiful girls. It was like all the beauty queens were in one place. Teenage beauty queens in one place. One thing I said to them was that you are the most beautiful bunch of girls here. And they looked at each other. As a monk, you shouldn't be lying, right? No, I don't lie. I don't lie. Why should I lie? Because I don't use the sugar-coated language. In fact, they were beautiful. Then I told them, you should have maintained, stick to a normal diet. Why did you put on that strict diet? Because you would have looked the same way, more beautiful now. Are we still beautiful? One girl asked. Yes, you are. But you'd have been remain more beautiful. If not, if you never went for that diet plan. So then I planted some positive thinking. I had them to meditate. So one thing I was that they were all happy. They had been going through a lot of dukkha. They were having second thoughts. In fact, there were some 11 girls. They told me that there was a 12th member. The 12th, they fell out with the 12th one. Why? She was the one who suggested that they went on diet. And she died. She died from anorexia. But they would still hate her. Then I asked him, the first thing you have to do is, You should have used your conscious mind to make the decision. Now, there's no point hating her. And especially, it's unethical to hate someone who is not with you anymore. And that kills your, that drains your energy. The first thing is you guys have to stop your wasteful thinking. And then I taught them some mindfulness meditation. I asked them for, and their parents took them to me and them close to a park, little park close to in the vicinity of the Eiffel Tower, so that we made it. I was there like 3 days. So then I then two girls, they still contact with me, and then they went on a normal diet, but they started looking more attractive. Why? They would still suffer from the anorexia. Why did they start looking more pleasant now? Because they were able to cope with that worry that they went for that strict diet. I didn't do a miracle, but only thing I did was so that I helped them to overcome that worry, that dukkha. Had they continued with that dukkha, some of them would have taken their own life. Because I think five or six girls were already suicidal. Now, so that is one of the best examples of dukkha. One of the two girls that used to who communicate with me went to the Plum Village, went to Baltiknathan's place, and she became a meditator, and then now she has become a role model for anorexia patients. Anorexia patient. Now she would say, okay, Bhante, I got enrolled in this coursework, and I met the Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh before his death. I'm a member of the Plum Village. I practice Vipassana. Now I taught a board meditation. Board meditation, is one of the types of Vipassana meditation, the board meditation. I asked her to I collect beautiful skeletons. So he has a dancing skeletons. I suggested that because I also have a collection in my room in Sri Lanka, all around. Monks use them for meditation, bone meditation. I use them for fun actually, for meditation also. I started collecting those pictures, not actual skeletons, but in Sri Lanka you can get an actual skeleton when you write to the court of law, to the judge, who I guess you can get one. Some meditation centers have actual skeletons belonging to late monks. So I asked them to observe, and she said, and she understood the beauty of skeletons. And thereby, whenever she stood in front of the mirror, and when she looked at her ribs popping up in the mirror. And she simply, I asked them to do the meditation, touch them and like this. Okay. And so that he slowly, she was a, slowly and steadily, she was able to transform her agonizing experience of anorexia into something pleasant. Now she is fast improving and she is on a good diet. So that is how sometimes people go to denial, they get depressed, but always there's a way out, according to Buddha Dhamma. Now, so that's what happened to our. That's because of, you can put the blame on yourself. That's how we are. That is our identity. That's our sattvas. There's nothing wrong with that. The only way to counter our clinging to many different things is to plant the idea of bodhi in your head and always think about it. How many times have I enjoyed things? Have I been able to retain those pleasant experiences forever? No. What if I get enlightened one day? And then, but Bhante Upananda said that about the conversation, that one monk was frustrated that there's nothing to enjoy in at or about nirvana. But have I been able to enjoy continually with anything before nirvana in our life? No, I still complain. So that's why always Buddha encouraged us to see the value of nirvana by comparing it with our worldly experience. I personally totally discourage people to think about nirvana. And as I said the last week or so, Buddha has dedicated only few sutras to describe nirvana. All elsewhere he has done nothing but explaining what samsara is, what our experiences are, how agonizing, how pleasant our experiences can be, what our experience is, how our sankharas are. Because in other words, Buddha, throughout his teachings, Buddha has explained how to run the race. There's only one or two places that he had touched on the finish line and the victory. There's nothing to describe the finish line. Within seconds, you can cross the finish line. But actually, what is more important is the running the race. All his most of the, like 99% of his teachings are based on running the race. When you run the race, and you can win cross the line, and Buddha simply explains, okay, this is what nirvana is. But some people always ask me to describe nirvana, but they hardly talk about their race. I do everything possible to talk about my own running of the race, and I ask people to, okay, think about your own race. Thank you for today.